This is the What Now Podcast.
But I think the main point of never giving up and never giving up on yourself and believing that you deserve to be happy and you deserve to feel loved and you deserve all the wonderful things that life has to offer, by staying upset and angry, that just steals your life away from you. That steals the moments away from you that you could be happy. That's not to say you shouldn't be angry or upset. I should also work to be happy.
This is the What Now Podcast, where we have meaningful discussions to support, educate, and inspire members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I am Mary Alice Hatch, your host. Join me as I speak with Elizabeth Smart about her harrowing experience with being kidnapped at the vulnerable age of 14 and how she survived 9 months of captivity and sexual assault. Elizabeth shares what brought her comfort and hope during her captivity and how she has been able to move on with her life and find joy again. Elizabeth shares how she is using her public platform as a survivor of sexual assault to educate and empower children and adults nationwide. Today, I'm here with Elizabeth Smart. Welcome.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here.
Thank you for taking the time to join us today. We are going to be talking about sexual assault, recovery, awareness, and prevention today. Very important topics. Sexual assault is on the rise. According to a recent statistical analysis from 2023, 50% of women and 30% of men have experienced sexual violence. And the highest risk years for sexual violence are between 12 and 34. I mean, these are really disturbing statistics, Elizabeth.
They are really, honestly horrific. And I mean, I was on a flight not too long ago, well, back in October when it was Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And the airline I was on, they had a big push about, you know, donating to support breast cancer, which I'm all for. I mean, my aunt had breast cancer. My mother-in-law had breast cancer. You know, my grandmother-in-law had breast cancer. I know a lot of women who have been affected by it. And they came on and they were talking and they said 1 in 6 women are affected by breast cancer. In my mind, I was like, wow, that's so terrible. But given the space that I'm in nationally, it's 1 in 5 women have been sexually abused. But in Utah, it's even higher. It's about 1 in 3. And so part of me is just like, wow, there is not enough awareness. We are not talking about this issue enough. We are not doing enough to educate and make aware and really all get on the same page that there is no form of rape or sexual violence that is ever okay. They are all abhorrent, and every single one of us, whether we are personally like directly affected by it or not, we are affected by it because we know someone, whether it's a mother or a sister or a friend or a spouse, or we do know someone who has been sexually abused. So the time to act is now. It's not in 10 years. It's now. Frankly, it was yesterday. It was 10 years ago. Yesterday was when we should have been acting.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with you. I mean, you have a really powerful platform to speak from through your experience. I mean, when you were only 14 years old, you were kidnapped from your home in Federal Heights neighborhood in Salt Lake City, Utah, at knife point, under the control of your captors for 9 months. I mean, I remember watching that horrific experience unfold on national television and praying for you and your family and your safe return. I mean, I can only imagine what it was like to suffer through an experience like that and then try to recover from such a horrific trauma. And I want to mention that before you were kidnapped, your maternal grandfather passed away, who you were very close to, and you shared in an interview with Terry Gross for NPR about how you felt your grandfather close to you while you were kidnapped. How did feeling kind of this beloved grandfather's presence with you during your captivity give you hope?
Well, my kidnapping, I mean, I don't know that there was anything that could have prepared me for being kidnapped. I mean, we do lots of prevention education nowadays. And even like I personally speak about prevention education specifically against sexual violence and kidnapping. And it's all wonderful information, but the truth is sometimes there are situations where you cannot fight back, where there's nothing you can do except survive, which might be doing exactly what these perpetrators are telling you to do. And I had never dreamt that it would have been possible that I would be kidnapped. It wasn't something that was spoken about. It wasn't anything like common. I mean, it was like stranger danger, like don't sneak out of the house, obey your parents. If you don't, then something's going to happen. That's how you'd get kidnapped, is if you were, you know, sneaking off or disobeying them, which of course I wasn't. I was at home in bed, like exactly where I was supposed to be, in the place that I thought was most safe on earth. And yet I was still kidnapped. And, you know, those first few days, like I really just felt so alone. I just felt just, I don't even know if I have words to really articulate it, but I felt so alone. I felt so isolated. I felt so, so much despair, really. And, before in the days and weeks leading up to my kidnapping, I mean, it had been a bit of a chaotic time. I mean, it was the end of the school year. There were six of us. Like, I don't know how my mom did it all. We all had projects due. We all had assignments. We all had, you know, it was just the big push to get to the end of the year. Not to mention my mom's dad, my grandpa, he had been diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor a few months earlier. And so they had tried to operate on it to remove this tumor, and they couldn't get it all out. It had like fingers that were going down into my grandpa's brain. And ultimately, I mean, from the time that I feel like he was diagnosed, I mean, I feel like it was January or February. And then he died the end of May, and we had the funeral the beginning of June. Well, I was kidnapped on June 5th. I mean, I was kidnapped like the day after the funeral, or maybe 2 days after the funeral. And I remember at the funeral just thinking, like, this is so unfair. Like, why is he dying? Like, he was always just like, he always seemed so big and strong as a kid. Like, that's my memory of him, of was just being like this big, strong man. And I mean, he and my grandma, they'd have these backyard parties, which were like the highlight of my summer as a kid. They had irrigation instead of a sprinkler system. And so they'd turn on the irrigation and it would flood the backyard. And I just thought that was like the coolest thing ever. Mm-hmm. And they would have homemade ice cream competitions and like backyard, you know, barbecues. And that was just like my favorite memories of the summer. And I just remember when he died, just being so sad, because that had just been such like a core memory for me. Like, regularly was going to their house and spending time with them. And so at the time I was really, really upset that he died, and I thought it was really unfair. And then of course, and then I was kidnapped, and then I felt all this just despair and aloneness and isolation. And the thought struck me that I'm going to say it the way it sounds in my brain. I'm not sure if it's going to come through. The thought struck me that, not that he knew I was going to be kidnapped. Of course, nobody knew I was going to be kidnapped, but maybe a kind and loving Heavenly Father knew that that might be in my future, and knew that I was going to need all the help and comfort I could get. And so maybe my grandfather could be more of a comfort and a support to me from the other side, instead of staying alive. But I guess that's how it comes out sounding, but just that, like, he could comfort me in a way that my parents couldn't comfort me, because they would be searching for me. They'd be looking for me. They were still alive, but my grandfather could be with me in spirit and provide me sort of a spiritual comfort in those days and weeks and months after I was kidnapped. And that thought always just brought me such comfort to think that maybe I wasn't as alone as I felt. I mean, physically, yes, I was very much alone, but maybe there were people that knew me and loved me who had already passed on, and they were watching over me and they were there with me. That thought always was very comforting to me.
Mm-hmm. And really would be, considering you were completely isolated. I mean, he had you hidden up in the hill. Right? I mean, in a very remote place where you are in total isolation, and just the thought of having your grandfather's presence or feeling of his presence there and that comfort, it's beautiful. I want to talk about trust. Okay, when you're taken at 14, that's such a vulnerable age. How have you been able to trust and move on with your life and find joy again from an experience like that? It's so traumatizing.
I mean, it was incredibly traumatizing, and there definitely are people and experiences and relationships that they've managed to lose my trust, or I just don't feel like I could ever trust them in the future. I mean, there's been plenty of those instances, but also I feel like I've seen the flip side of that as well. I mean, I have had so many people approach me and say, you know, I only remember where I was a few times in my life. And one of them was when you were rescued. And, or the many people who have said, you know, I searched for you, I prayed for you every night. I've just had so many of those experiences that I feel like there really are more good people in this world than there are bad. And so that's always been very encouraging to me. I feel like there is so much good in humanity that we should never really give up on humanity. And I get going, and then sometimes I forget what your original question is.
No, just building trust with people and moving on with your life. I mean, and finding joy. I mean, is there anything that was said to you that helped you realize, I am not going to let this man control my life anymore?
Well, it was my mother. I mean, it was the morning after I was rescued, and I was in talking with her, and she was just like, Elizabeth, what this man and this woman have done to you is terrible. There aren't words strong to describe how wicked and evil they are. They've stolen 9 months of your life that you'll never get back, but the best punishment you could ever give them is to be happy and to live your life and do all the things that, you know, you want to do, because you may never feel like justice was truly been served. They took things away from you that you'll never get back. But really the best punishment you can give them is to be happy. And I think she's absolutely right. I mean, I don't think that you go through something traumatic and you just make a decision, okay, I'm going to be happy now, and there'll be no, effects from whatever trauma you've experienced. But I think the main point of never giving up and never giving up on yourself and believing that you deserve to be happy and you deserve to feel loved and you deserve all the wonderful things that life has to offer, I mean, I think that's really important. And I think that's true for all of us, because so much of what each of us experience is consequences of, sure, certainly sometimes our actions, but a lot of times they're not our actions. A lot of times they just happen. I mean, whether it's illness or I don't know, like a car accident, if someone crashed into you, I mean, that's not consequences of something that you've done. And so I think you just give yourself the grace and give yourself the chance to realize that you deserve happiness, and that by staying upset and angry over what happens, that just steals your life away from you. That steals the moments away from you that you could be happy. That's not to say you shouldn't be angry or upset. I absolutely believe there is a place for those feelings. I just think that we should also work to be happy.
What inspired advice from your own mother right after that, where she just addressed that right away?
Absolutely, yes. But she's never been one to let me, I don't know, wallow in misery either. She's always, I mean, growing up, she just always was like, Elizabeth, what do when a horse bucks you off? That's right, you get back up. You know, what do you do when you fall down? That's right, you get back up. And she definitely stayed true to form in those moments. You get back up, you keep going, you don't give up.
Mm-hmm. And did you feel empowered by that? You know, hearing that from your own mother, like, okay, that's a core memory. I'm going to turn it around. I'm not going to let this steal a second more of my life.
I mean, in the moment that she actually said that to me, there was, I mean, probably very ungraciously of me. I thought, why are you telling me this right now? I just got back. Like, I have missed out on so much already. Do you really think I want to miss out on more? Like, I had some serious FOMO while I was kidnapped. Mm-hmm. And so at the time I was like, you don't need to tell me this. I know that. But I mean, as time has gone on, I mean, there certainly have been times where it has been very difficult and very frustrating. I mean, the trial, it took the better part of a decade, you know, before everything was finished. And that seemed ridiculous. How could anybody think that this man wasn't guilty? I mean, he was. Everyone knew he did it. And yet it was able to be drug out for years and years. I mean, that felt unfair. There's been a lot of things that have been frustrating or unfair, but I think that's when that memory of my mom really comes through.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I love that when George W. Bush was in office in 2003, he invited all the formerly kidnapped children with their families to surround him as he signed the Amber Alert package into law at the White House. What was it like being there with other kids who had also been taken and witnessed such a proactive law being created to identify captured kids and information about their captors so they could be found more quickly? Did that help you in your healing?
I mean, it was amazing because I really didn't know anyone else who had ever been kidnapped. At the time, I felt like I was the only one. I mean, I hadn't met anyone else who spoke openly about it. I just didn't know anyone else who spoke about it. So at the time, and at the White House signing in the Rose Garden, I mean, there were other survivors there. There were a lot of parents of children who did not survive, who had been kidnapped. It was very special, but I think even still at that time, I mean, it was very soon after I was rescued. Even then, I did not understand the magnitude of what was happening that day, because I did not understand just how prevalent kidnappings are. I mean, it still felt like they were far and few between, but they're not. I mean, they're very common, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting, too, on that note, is that sexual abuse most commonly occurs within the victim's close friend circles and social circles. I mean, for adolescents and young adults, this often means the assailant is a relative, a close friend, a teacher, a coach, or even an immediate family member. And so this can be so confusing since the person's known to them, right? And allowing a more vulnerable interaction than with a stranger. So I'd like to shift gears and talk about this. You know, when someone finds themselves in a vulnerable situation, what should they do? How can they get out of it safely?
I mean, I think this is such an important topic because You're absolutely right. What you've said is absolutely right. The majority of abuse happens by someone that you know. That could be a parent, that could be a family member, that could be a nanny, that could be a neighbor, that could be someone trusted in your community, maybe someone who holds some kind of maybe elected office or a leader in a religious setting. I mean, it can be literally anybody. And I've met too many survivors where they start comparing what they went through to what I went through. And somehow they get in their minds that what they went through isn't as bad as what I went through. But I would almost want to switch that around and say, no, you know, I did not experience the level of betrayal that you have experienced because I didn't know my captors. I mean, I didn't have a relationship with them. So from the onset, they were always bad. I never thought they were good people. I always knew they were bad people. So all the things they did to me stayed in line with how I viewed them, which wasn't good. Whereas when you know these people who are hurting you, maybe you know a good side of them, or maybe the community sees them as good people, or maybe it's a family member and a lot of your family loves them, or, you know, it can be so, so difficult to really break the silence. I mean, your average child has to tell 5 different people before they're believed. 5. Like, can you believe that? 5 different people before they're believed. And from what I've seen over the past 20 years, it's the first person that really sets the trajectory for that survivor, whether they go on to get help or whether they end up bottling it inside them. I mean, so if the first person responds with belief and support and love, then in my experience, the survivor is willing to take it to the next levels. But if they're just shut down, then what's happened to them is already so traumatic and they feel like they got brave. They came to someone that they thought they could trust. And then that person doesn't believe them or starts interrogating them, trying to decide whether or not they're worthy to be believed. I mean, that can be absolutely devastating. And I mean, it's just like, it's not fair. I've always thought that it was so great that our justice system was innocent until proven guilty. Like I used to just think that was the way all justice systems should be. But now as an adult and as a survivor and as someone who has worked in this space advocating for other survivors, part of me thinks, no, in cases of child abuse and sexual abuse and sexual exploitation and kidnapping, no, you should be guilty until you're proven innocent, because most people are not lying. It's very few. It's the exception who lies about saying something happened. You are always going to be safer to believe someone when they say they've been raped or sexually abused. You are much more likely to, I want to say be correct. Your belief is correct. Then have them lie about it. So
it's tricky because when someone's a small child, and this could really blow up a family if this comes out that grandpa's been molesting you or the uncle or the best friend next door, and then it starts kind of really affecting the integrity of the family, the reputation of the family, the fallout that comes from all of that. When a 6-year-old saying something, I mean, how does that child have a voice if no one's listening to them? I mean, that's the tricky part, right? I mean, how, when they're young, how do they get listened to?
It is hard. And I think that's why as parents and community members, we need to have these conversations. And unfortunately, like, I do think we need to have conversations around sexual abuse, like with kids when they are younger, which I know is a sticky topic. I know it's hard. And believe me, like, I'll be the first one to tell you, I don't particularly want to have those conversations with my own kids, but I also recognize how common this issue is, this problem is. And I do not, like, if I can prevent it from happening to my kids, I'd rather have a difficult, uncomfortable conversation with them than not. As well as, I think it's really imperative that we do have open conversations with our kids just all the time, and that we are building trust and they know that we believe them and we support them. I mean, like, I realize I am not a survivor of familial abuse. So there are areas that I might not be as I don't even know what the right word is, because I've not experienced that form of abuse. I maybe cannot speak as personally to that exact form, mm-hmm. but like this really, when it comes to abuse in society, it really penetrates every level that you can think of, because even if a survivor or a victim is taken out of a situation of abuse, their story doesn't end right there. That doesn't just because they're not being raped in that moment or going forward anymore does not mean that their story or that abuse or their trauma has ended right there. If that makes sense.
That's an important point. Yeah. I mean, what do we need to be teaching our children to help prevent a situation where they could be vulnerable?
Absolutely. And we need to continue to have these conversations, honestly, like in every stage of life and with regularity, because for instance, I was on a flight a few years ago and I fell asleep because that's what I do on planes. I sit down and it's like I flip a switch and I'm exhausted and just fall asleep. But I woke up towards the end of the flight with the passenger sitting next to me reaching across the armrest and like rubbing up the inside of my leg. And here I am, probably one of the more visible and outspoken advocates in this space. And I talk about these kinds of instances all the time, but I was so shocked that it was happening to me again that I just froze. And I first of all want to say that is a completely normal response to freeze. There's actually four very common responses. There's fight, flight, freeze, and then the last one is appease, which a lot of people confuse with Stockholm syndrome. It's not. It's basically doing whatever you have to do in that moment to survive. So it doesn't, it from the outside, it might look like you're going along with your perpetrators, but really you're doing that because you're just trying to stay alive. So there are those four main responses. And for me, one of my responses is to freeze. And that's exactly what I did on that airplane as that man was rubbing up my leg, was just to freeze. And it took a while before I could actually physically take his hand off of me and move it away. And then, I mean, I ended up reporting it to the airline and I ended up reporting it to the FBI. But my point is that you are much less likely to react or respond unless it's something that you are practicing regularly, unless it's something that you're talking about regularly, unless it's something that you're aware of regularly. And all of these, all of the different things that we can talk about, they're tools. And sometimes, you know, the tool will come readily available. You'll know exactly what to do. And sometimes, you know, sometimes you won't. Sometimes those tools won't appear or you won't remember what to do. And that's okay. That's not doing anything wrong. It's just these conversations are important so that you can have tools, you know, if that moment appears. Have options. That's what I'm trying to say. These conversations and education is really important so that you have options.
Okay, I'm actually shocked that he would even try to do something like that in a public setting with a public figure like yourself who speaks against this constantly. That's just crazy to me that he tried to do that. Go ahead.
Well, I think he probably had no idea who I was because, I mean, it was really early in the morning. And as soon as I sat down, like I had a hooded sweatshirt on and I pulled up the hood of my sweatshirt and I just like kind of leaned against the window of the airplane and fell asleep. So I wasn't facing him or anything. I think he just saw an opportunity, which also brings me to the next point, is that a lot of perpetrators, they just look for opportunity. That is how they operate. So they'll look for the loner. They'll look for the person who maybe doesn't have friends or who's vulnerable or maybe has a disability or maybe they're left alone after school or maybe like or they live with a person who isn't paying attention to where they're walking. Maybe they're glued to their phone, or maybe the person that just looks shy, that sends their body language, sends the vibe of insecurity. These are all things that perpetrators look for, is vulnerability, is opportunity.
So, yeah, I remember going to a RAD class. We're going to talk about that a little bit, what you're doing with that. But I went to one of those RAD classes, and one of the things they say, it's a prevention class on how to physically protect yourself, and that we take it. I took it at the police department. But it talks about never being on your phone. Always be looking around. Always make eye contact. Always intimidate if someone's coming up to you that you feel might be threatening, right? Like, be aware. I mean, college campuses are particularly prone to sexual misconduct and assault. I mean, we're seeing a rise in sexual assault on university campuses. I mean, 26% of female undergraduate students and almost 7% of male undergraduate students, they're reporting experiencing sexual assault. I mean, what should universities be offering to better educate and empower university students?
Well, and that's just the thing. These are only the numbers that are being reported. How many more are not being reported? What if the school you go to has a
honor code?
Yes, has an honor code, where if you're caught in another person, another member's of the opposite gender's house, there's going to be repercussions, or too many. I've spoken with too many individuals who have shared their story with me, have told me what has happened to them, but because they knew their perpetrator, because they were dating their perpetrator, because it was a friend, because it was someone that they knew or trusted prior to this incident, they didn't say what had happened to them was rape. They said sex. And I recognize there are, no one can always read between every line, and no one's a mind reader, and the volume of people that probably come and sit through their offices is a lot. So do I have compassion and empathy for bishops and leaders? Absolutely, I do. But at the same time, I've heard too many stories where a girl or an individual has been raped, and then they went to their bishop's office to report, well, to talk what had happened, because they didn't understand what had happened to them was rape. And then they get put on academic probation. They're stopped from taking the sacrament. They're told they need to go through the repentance process, when what they've already experienced is something that they should have never experienced in the first place.
And oh, yeah, it just adds like, to their me, trauma.
That makes me want to, like, I don't know. I just burn with rage when I hear those stories.
Well, it adds to their trauma, right? I mean, here they are being vulnerable, admitting to something that happened that was traumatic and maybe not necessarily the best situation. We talked about that. Maybe don't go in situations where you're isolated and alone in a back bedroom, where that's more likely to happen. But that could happen in public somewhere too. It could be happening when you're walking on a trail up in the canyon and you're alone. I mean, you never know.
I mean, it could happen in a car. It could absolutely happen. Yeah. Happen anywhere. And I mean, like, I guarantee rape has happened under every stupid excuse there is. I mean, I need help moving, like, I'm moving apartments. I need help moving this table. Will you come into my room and just help? I mean, it could be as stupid as that. Mm-hmm. Like a full-on, like, date rape drug.
So what do students watch out for? I mean, how can they just heighten their awareness just a little bit? I know some of these things are beyond their control. They could go to the bathroom and something slipped in their drink. But maybe they get – I mean, I know – when I was at college, I felt a few times very uncomfortable around certain people. And then I was like, well, maybe I'm rude if I excuse myself and then I'm offending them. And I just think, gosh, why would we ever, if we have a feeling or an impression like that, we need to follow it.
I couldn't agree more. And honestly, I feel like I've been the same person. And even though I say another person's feelings is not as important as your safety, even though I say those kinds of things, I'm not great at following that either. I mean, there's plenty of times where I overly worry, well, will this offend them? Will that offend them? Will this offend them? And I mean, like, personally, like, I'm like, no, this shouldn't matter. Like, do I feel comfortable? No, the answer is no. Then what would make me feel more comfortable? Well, leaving would make me feel more comfortable. Well, then just do it, Elizabeth. Like, put on your big girl pants and do it. Mm-hmm. But even still, I think we're all just trained to be very conscious and very aware of other people's emotions. And I mean, we do live in a world where it's hard to say, to really make bold statements without receiving some form of backlash or hate from some direction. And where emotions and feelings are so important, and where these feelings and emotions consistently need to be validated, like, it can be really tricky to maneuver. But I will just say it again, if you don't feel safe, your first priority should be your safety, not worrying about whether or not you're going to offend someone else.
Mm-hmm. Will you tell me a little bit about the work you're doing now with self-defense at SNOW, SEU College? You're working on a few things right now. Do you want to share that with us?
Yes, absolutely. I'd love to. So my foundation, the Elizabeth Smart Foundation, we created a self-defense course called Smart Defense. We do have locations up and down the Wasatch Front and in some of the surrounding states. We also have it available online, although I will say in person is always the best. We have also been able to build relationships with some of the universities in Utah and Idaho, where we are implementing Smart Defense as an accredited class into their class offerings, which is incredible because, as you were saying earlier, you know, like, the statistics for sexual assault on campus are only rising. And I mean, you're 2 times more likely to have a violent rape completed on you than you are to be robbed as a student. I mean, that's pretty crazy, right?
That's scary. Yeah.
So, I mean, these numbers are something that universities really should be thinking about and addressing and really taking a very proactive approach. So our Smart Defense class, it is a combination of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Krav Maga, and Muay Thai. It is also trauma-informed. And we have a lot of practices that involve breath work that kind of try to help bring you back to that center you, because it can be a bit triggering. Like our instructors, everything is consent based. I mean, they will ask you before they ever touch you, before they ever do any kind of demonstration with you or practice with you, you know, can I do this? Is this okay? And so it is very much consent based, but it still can be a little bit jarring. For instance, you know, I've done the program myself many times and it's incredible. But when my director puts her hands on my neck and puts even just a little bit of pressure on my neck, I mean, it's a bit of a shock because nobody touches my neck. I mean, nobody places their hands around my neck in everyday life. I mean, like, not even my husband does that. Like, nobody puts pressure on my neck. And mm-hmm. So it can be a bit shocking having that experience for the first time, or maybe not even the first time, maybe the 10th time, maybe the 100th time. Mm-hmm. And so it is, there are a lot of elements that are involved. So we have a lot of, yes, as I mentioned, we are very trauma-informed. We're very consent-based. It's the combination of these different martial arts. And ultimately, our purpose is to give you enough skills to get away, to get to safety. It's not to stay and engage in combat with them. It's to give yourself the chance, the break for freedom to get away from the situation. That is the best goal. I mean, we start out with something as simple as yelling, which I have to say is incredible. I've sat and observed many classes coming through. I've been part of many classes. And I would say really no one or very few women actually like scream at 100% volume when we ask them to. The loudest we get the first time we ask them to is maybe 50% of what their volume capacity is, because they laugh or they feel funny or they feel like, oh, well, yes, of course I'd scream in a situation if that ever arose, but we're just here. We're just nice women together, which like I understand. I've been there. I've been that woman. But if you can't scream in that situation, there's a pretty good chance you won't be able to scream when you need to. Mm-hmm. So even something as simple as practicing screaming can be very effective.
It's interesting that you just said that, because we had a friend of ours that lived in the neighborhood you were in, adjacent to the neighborhood that you were in Federal Heights. And they were so worried about their daughters, because their daughters slept downstairs and they were upstairs. And so they would have trainings every night for screaming, like training their kids to be able to scream, you know, so they could, because they weren't comfortable doing it. You know, they would do these practices where they would kind of be scared and they would be silent. And so they had to be kind of trained in that consistency that you're talking about and practice, so it becomes comfortable to us, right?
Yes. I think that's so important. I mean, like I've had my kids practice screaming and they look at me and they laugh and they think it's silly, but I keep having them do it. And honestly, now that you're saying that, I think, oh, it's been a little bit. I need to get back into the habit of doing that again.
Mm-hmm. Well, in our little pre-interview, we were also talking too about changing things up in children's education. I feel like in the health program, we talk about stop, drop, and roll. What are the chances one of these kids is going to catch on full fire versus the statistics we just learned about today with sexual assault? I mean, how can we like weave this into the curriculum so every child is aware of this?
Yeah. So, you know, I was interested and I came across a number where it said it was like 1 in 600 and something. But so I just rounded up and say it's about 1 in 700 people actually use stop, drop, and roll. Everybody knows stop, drop, and roll, right? Like catch on fire. What do you do? Stop, drop, and roll. Like everybody knows that. That's for 1 in 700 people, basically. We're talking about something that's affecting 1 in 3 women, you know, 1 in 5 men, like children, 1 in 7 children as they're like in elementary age children, 1 in 7, like these numbers that we have, like there's so much more than 1 in 700. Mm-hmm. Like why aren't we talking about this earlier on? For instance, Prevent Child Abuse Utah, they have a great training that is totally age appropriate, and they want as advocates in the community, they want the parents to be involved. They want you to come see what they're doing so that you are comfortable with them teaching your children. There are resources available, and it just blows my mind that we are not utilizing them to their full and max capacity, that this isn't mandated for every child in every school in Utah, and honestly, every school everywhere, because the numbers are as horrific as they are. Mm-hmm. There are ways. You don't have to be graphic and explicit with kindergartners or first graders or third graders. I mean, the conversation can grow in an age appropriate way with your child as your child grows up. What you talk to your 18-year-old high schooler a senior in high school is going to be different than what you talk to your third grader about.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a way to do that that's age appropriate and honestly is going to help them, because this education, if we can give kids this education, it's not just going to serve them while they're kids. This isn't mm-hmm. just education for a year or 6 months. No, this education, it should be repeated. should be consistent throughout their life, and it will serve them throughout their life. Because
and empower them, right? Yeah. I mean, so they feel like, gosh, I'm hearing this every year since I was in first grade. And then they build upon what they can do based on the age that they're in to, if anything happens, they've actually got something to draw on.
Exactly. And as we were talking at the beginning of our conversation, how I said, you know, it takes the average child five times before they find someone who believes them. Like, you can every year be going through your mind and be like, who are the five people? Who are my five people? So that heaven forbid it ever happened to you. But if it does, you know immediately who those five people are that you can reach out to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love your platform of education, empowerment, awareness. And, you know, in 2013, your memoir titled My Story was released. And how is writing that story part of your initiative here, your awareness initiative?
It's interesting because I never thought that after I was rescued, I was like, yeah, I never want to talk about what happened. I never want to write a book. I just want that part of my life to disappear. As time went on, of course, it didn't disappear. And the trial happened. And during the trial, I was on the stand for many hours, and I had to talk about things that I had never spoken about with anyone. And by the time that was finished, I just felt like I had to go and basically regurgitate like a lot of the very difficult, worst moments of my life. If that's going to become public knowledge, I want to give it some context. I want to give it some perspective and what led up to it and what happened after and how that made me feel. Because if this is going to be out there, then I want it to serve a purpose. I don't just want it to be out there for, I don't know, people's enjoyment, mm-hmm. or further to appease curiosity. Like, I want it to serve a purpose. And so that's what pushed me to write my book, My Story, because there are so many survivors out there just like me, and they deserve to have their stories told, and they deserve to know that they're not alone and that there are other people out there who are not afraid to share the worst parts of their life and the things that has happened to them.
And you've modeled that by writing a book like this that's so transparent, so vulnerable, so real, that it really gives a voice to these other kids who feel like they don't have a voice.
I mean, that is certainly the hope.
Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to wrap up with just some final thoughts, the takeaways that you would really like people to understand and know about this initiative, the importance of it, and what people can do to further the message that you've started.
Well, first of all, begin having conversations in your own homes. I know it can be scary and hard, but just start talking with your children. You know your children better than anybody else, so you know what they are, you know best, like what they're able to comprehend and understand and what is age appropriate for them. That being said, I think kids understand a whole lot these days, and there's so much in the media, and there's so much in pop culture just around us all the time. We probably should give them a little more credit than what we think they know. They probably know a little bit more. But being aware, being open, building that trust with your child, having these regular conversations about safety, about what to do if something happens. I mean, if you're in Utah or the surrounding area, definitely go to ElizabethSmartFoundation.org and look into Smart Defense. We offer classes. We typically, at the youngest we'll usually go is about 11 years old, but it's a really great for like mothers and daughters to take together. It's an easy way to begin those conversations right there, and something that you can do together. Like, I love it when I see moms and daughters coming in and taking it together. But also then, like, for instance, right this minute, we are in the legislative season. contact your representatives. Tell them what you want. Tell them you want prevention education put in schools, that this is important, that, you know, statistics are too high for us to sit back and do nothing and just let it continue, because we do have the power to change statistics. I mean, I want to say we have the power to eradicate sexual abuse, but honestly, we will only do that when abusers stop abusing. But we certainly can limit how much it's happening. We can certainly, we could affect it that we could see a big change in numbers. They don't have to be as bad as they are today. Mm-hmm. So be proactive and don't just wait for your neighbor to do something, because if we all do that, nothing will ever happen.
Exactly. I love, we'll end on that point, that we have the power and ability to create change, positive change in this world. Thank you so much for your vulnerability, for your message today. It's powerful. It's important. And we can all be a part in contributing to this positive change. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the What Now podcast. Please share this episode with family, friends, and anyone you think it might help. If you enjoyed the podcast, please take a minute to leave a positive rating and written review, which really helps the podcast to grow. If you're on Instagram, follow us at @podcastwhatnow for inspirational messages and highlights from our past and present episodes. We never say goodbye, we say what now. This has been a What Now podcast production.